What I'd like to do is to, if you like, utilise some of my experiences in the international arena, in the professional international arena, to communicate to you some of the things that Formica was talking about, which in fact are quite relevant to our field. And I think I'd like to look at it from perhaps four standpoints. One is the tools of the translator, the other is the practice of translation, and I use translation with a capital T, the training of translators, and finally, if nothing else, should bring us to certain realisations and certain reflections upon where are we in the total global professional scenario, if you like. And let me start with that by saying that OZIT as an organisation with its 700 members is somewhere around the middle in terms of size of broadly, you know, of Interpreter and Translators Associations around the world. There are some huge associations like the American Translators Association, which has something like 8,500 members, but there are also some associations like the Namibian Association, which has 4 members. So I think, you know, that's where we fit, and it's perhaps a cliche to say, but all the things that we talk about and we feel very strongly about and debate, etc., are duplicated almost exactly in many, many, many other places. And in the last few years, that congruence has become even more apparent, only because the things that we do in Australia, that we've been doing in terms of community-based interpreting, are becoming an issue in other parts of the world. If you look at, for example, the whole of Europe, it's had to really make some decisions very quickly on what they were going to do with the situations which arise out of mass arrivals of people. And we had a chance to do that belatedly, but with a bit more leisure back in the 70s and after that. So all those things that we've talked about are reflected in some of the things that are happening in other associations and other systems all over the world. And I think it's probably good every now and then, before going on about the future, to actually think about the place of translators in history. And there have been some very interesting books written on the history of translation, and they're very informative. But I think that it's important to note that translators are actually the catalyst for change in history. I mean, he was talking about the Romans, etc. But even more recently, if you think about the meaning of the translation of the Bible, what that had, what effects that had. And there's also a recently published book called The Bible and Its Translators, which is also instructive in looking at the actual, dare I say, use the word, Chris, cultural ramifications of translation. And I think it's good to not to lose sight of that, because in every job that we do, the job may be 300 words, and you may not be able to see or think about this broader, more important function that one is undertaking. But if you put it all together, there's really a great deal of change created by translators. So let me see now. Let's look at, for example, the way that this marketplace is changing and is likely to change. And in the last few years, and I think it's probably difficult to be more precise than that, than saying, you know, 3 years ago, whatever, changes have occurred to the business of translation as well as to the process of translation. And I think that in terms of the business of translation, I needn't repeat what has been said over the last couple of days, the fact that especially in this country, well, in fact worldwide, there's been a diminution in terms of staff translator positions and an increase in freelance work and the whole debate about employees and contractors, etc., etc. The move has caused even large employers to go to a contract situation. It's happened even at the European Union. So it is fairly clear that that's happened. But what is perhaps not so much publicised is something that Ilka said before, and that more and more translators are being asked to themselves to form consortia in order to obtain jobs, in order to tender for jobs. So, as an example, the European Union wants something translated into 12 languages. It still has an in-house setup, but if it doesn't want to use that, it will then put out tenders and it will ask the people to form groups. Okay? And that puts the onus and the expense on the individual translators, and the importance of liaison with colleagues, not only in your own language group, but across the profession, becomes self-evident. And I think that in this country, of course, the compulsory competitive tendering, which exists in one form or another in all the states, will actually force us to do that as well. And I'm sure there are people in this room who've had the experience, even if it's not for such a variety of languages. So I think that in terms of the business of translation, that's one effect or one move that we have to really deal with in the future. The other sad fact is that the move to freelance translators has in fact depressed the market in terms of price. The more competition you have, then the likelihood is that the price comes down, and of course then we need to look at on what basis do we compete. And I won't go into that, but I mean it's obvious that we have to find measures of quality which are understandable to our clients, and not simply how quickly we answer our phone when we get a phone call for a job. And now, of course, in the other sense, the business of translation has gone global, and I won't labour that point. It's been made time and again. But I just want to note that the phenomenon of separating the translator from his or her client physically has interesting ramifications. And I'm sure some of you do jobs who don't even see the client, whereas this profession was dependent on face-to-face and, you know, delivery of bits of paper and this sort of stuff. And I think that some of these effects are not necessarily positive for the future, the fact that we are just dealing, you know, with a screen. The translation itself is now regarded as a product or a service, and therefore it suffers from the same vagaries and considerations that any other service or product does. And so we need to recognise that that's really not likely to go backwards. And so there are a number of consequences, and some of these are clear. One of them is dumping. And the fact that Morena, for example, is doing work for Italy also means that somebody who used to get that work in Italy is not doing it anymore. Okay? And I've said this before, how especially in the recently... In the countries of Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union, there's been a lot of translation work done at very much ridiculous prices, which has caused quite considerable difficulties in countries like Germany. Okay. So that's another effect. The further thing is that the marketplace has dictated that the translator make a considerable personal investment in hardware and software. You know, the days of the typewriter or just a computer are certainly gone, and so you would need to invest in a certain number of technologies and keep them up to date. And that is a consequence of this sort of globalization, technology, etc. The fact that even a few short years ago you could hand in a Chinese translation handwritten, and now nobody would take it, means, you know, a lot. Not only that, not only camera ready, but also compatible with all sorts of other arrangements, which is the company or whoever wants the translation, ask of you. Of course, there are some areas in translation that will remain somewhat antediluvian, and I think this is mainly the area, in terms of technologies, I mean, and that is mainly in the area of literary translation, as we heard this morning, but also in the very nature of that process that was put on the board this morning. It just doesn't suit the kind of things that I'm talking about, which are requirements for any other kind of translation. So the positives which have emerged from this scenario are that firstly, each translator's potential market has expanded, and we've said this again. Concomitantly, the resources available to the translator have grown exponentially, and the accuracy and currency of the resources has increased to the point that energy has to be invested in limiting the information overload, which can easily be counterproductive to your own translation process. And I think that a couple of people today have alluded to the fact that you can't take everything that you see on the internet as gospel, if I can use that term. So, you know, these are things that are impinging upon the process. And the other controversial issue, I think, is the expansion of the scope of translation as an activity. And again, I use that to include interpreters here. And it's interesting in the evolution of any profession to observe the tension which exists between the pioneers, if you like, in inverted commas, and the latest recruits to the profession, especially in terms of how each group sees the fundamentals of that profession and how each group defines the profession. And this is true especially of recent professions, and we should count ourselves in that number, even though, of course, as you know, interpreting has been called the oldest profession in the world. So,
second oldest.
Second oldest. Okay. Forgive the exaggeration. Okay. So, we have had always this difficulty in communicating to our clients the distinction between language competence and translation competence. And this difficulty persists, even though there's a lot more of us, I think, now who can actually make a good fist about saying it. And I think that some people might shake their heads and say, my God, you know, what we're doing now is not translation at all. We should stop it. And I think we have to be open to movement. And I think that Professor Formica, in fact, almost said as much. The fact that people need to see the scope of the task differently. And I'm not going to sort of say what's going to happen, but I think that maybe not all the things he enumerated, but we've had hints of that even this morning in other discussions here. So some of the things that I've observed, which, you know, affect me when I'm in front of the computer translating, are things like the fact that the translator is often asked not just, and I use that word, to translate, but to actually to conform to a company style, okay? And to conform the company style, which may be completely anathema to your own views about what should go there. And you reject it and you resent it. But then the point comes where you have to make a decision as to whether you take the job or don't take the job under those conditions. And beyond that, beyond the company style, is what is called a controlled language, where companies in fact assign certain semantic values to some lexicon, and you as a translator need to learn that in order to actually do the translation which is satisfactory for that company. And we can ask Tony McGillicuddy, but I'm pretty sure that Fujitsu had extensive manuals to get people to comply with this. So some of these things are anathema, but I don't think that we can just simply ignore them. I think that the essential element in all this is that we have to focus on the real nub of what we do. And after all, the reason that we've been so strong in defending the strict limits of translation is in a way an expression of our own defensive approach, because people have not valued us very much. So it's comforting and it's important to actually define it so that you can actually argue about it. But I think that this thinking has to change. It will change anyway, whether we like it or not. I think very few words about the tools of the translator. I think that I won't go through a whole lot of things that I'm sure you know very well, but I just wish to mention one thing, and that is the arguments that are going on worldwide about the use of and the abuse of translation memory. Now, I'm not sure, we don't have data, as Chris keeps saying, but we don't have data on how many people are actually using translation memory in their work here in Australia, but certainly it has become a huge issue in North America and in Europe because of the way that this is being treated, and translators are asked to sell or to, if you like, give up the translation memory when they do a certain job, and then the client can use it, give it to another translator and say to the translator, well, there's 80% is in here, you do 20%, you get paid for 20%. Okay, so these are issues that are current, and maybe they're not as immediate for us, but certainly that's the trend, that's the way it's going. I think my time is up, but I'd like to just make one comment about the way that the profession is organising itself. I think there has been a trend in the last couple of years for, on the one hand, larger and larger organisations to emerge, incorporating other related professions. So you've had, for example, the Belgians, who have included terminologists in their group, and also the Canadians, and this is a trend which is going on. And of course, there is another sector of our profession which are sometimes called media translators, and including surtitling, subtitling, voiceovers, and things like that, who at the moment are only sort of debating the nexus between their profession and translation, but are also organising themselves separately at the moment in some countries. So I think these are some of the things that we have to think about, and of course there are others which I haven't had a chance to deal with, but I think that the knowledge pools that Professor Formica was talking about is an interesting concept, and just to know that some countries are actually basing the whole economic planning for their nation on the idea of knowledge, and Malaysia is one country that does that. So thank you. I'm sorry I've been sort of a bit not very lucid, perhaps, because I'm just trying to jump from one thing to another here. Thank you.